just start with testimony. Oh, there I am. Finally mic'd. All right, thanks. We will start with Mr. Martin. And please identify yourself for the tape.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Larry Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. I'm a member of the nonpartisan joint agency staff, and I work for the 10-member commission that handles public employee pensions and retirement. And that's, I'm going to try and give you a brief sense of what the commission does, what Minnesota public pension plans do, and what current funding shape the plans are in. You can also schedule to have presentations by the State Board of Investments and the administrators of the three major pension plans. And I want to leave enough time for them, so I have relatively brief comments. The pension commission, well, Minnesota has been in the business of public employee pensions for a good long time. The first pension plans in the state of Minnesota were created in the 1870s. The first state aid program for pensions was created in the 1870s. The fire state aid program, when Minnesota first taxed insurance companies and dedicated part of the proceeds of that tax to fire, both fire equipment and fire pensions, and eventually became only fire pensions. So, key dates in the past, 1909 for the first class city teachers, 1915 the first statewide teacher plan, 1919 the MERF, the Minneapolis Employees Plan, was created, 1929 the State Employees Pension Plan was created, 1931 the PERA plan was created, 1935 in the 1930s. The first statewide teacher plan was replaced with the current DRA when it fell into funding problems in the Great Depression. And subsequent to then, a number of other Minnesota pension plans were created. The way that policymaking used to occur in the legislature was it depended upon what type of employee was covered. And the committee with jurisdiction was the committee that covered that substantive area. Hence, teacher pensions were covered by the Education Committee, judicial pensions were covered by the Judiciary Committee, and so forth. Sometime in the 1960s, the pension plans were viewed, the issue of pensions was viewed as topical and was placed within the governmental operations committee or civil administration committees, as they sometimes are referred to. The Minnesota Pension Commission was set up as an interim commission in 1955, primarily to address the issue of a likely or looming possibility of default in PERA, the Public Employees Pension Plan, one of our largest by membership plans. The Pension Commission was made a permanent commission of the legislature in 1967 and has continued since then. Initially, when the commission was first set up, the commission was really members of this committee and of its counterpart in the Senate. The two governmental operations committees had pension subcommittees, and the Pension Commission was really the meeting or a joint meeting of both the pension subcommittees of the House and Senate.
Excuse me, Mr. Martin, I'm just going to interrupt for a second. We do have a quorum present, so I'm going to call the meeting officially to order. Please proceed, Mr. Martin.
Thank you. Currently, the Pension Commission is made up of 10 members, five from the House, chosen by the Speaker, five from the Senate, chosen by the Subcommittee on Committees of the Senate Rules Committee. It elects its own chair, and the membership has now been drawn more widely or more broadly from the legislature and is not housed totally out of the two governmental operations committees. The Pension Commission hears bills as if it had jurisdiction of the bills, even though it technically does not. Works off of amendments, does put together a set of recommendations to this committee, typically in the form of one or more omnibus pension bills. They're usually presented towards the end of your bill hearing period. The Pension Commission does appear in the joint rules with respect to the target date or the bill hearing deadline date, and the Pension Commission has until the second deadline to produce its recommendations. So typically, the chair or vice chair of the Pension Commission would appear before your committee, depending upon whether the House or Senate holds the chair. This year, this biennium, the House is to hold the chair of the Pension Commission. The chair and I would appear before you to go over the recommendations contained in the omnibus pension bill, which would be in the form of a large delete everything amendment to a carrier bill. The Pension Commission has a small staff. Ed Burek, my deputy, and I are the professionals on the staff. We also have a 1.5-time FTE clerical force. We also retain a consulting actuary who reviews and audits the actuarial work prepared by the various public employee pension plans. Milliman is the actuarial firm out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Minnesota, for better or for worse, has the second largest number of public employee pension plans in the country. Only Pennsylvania has more. Last time I checked, Pennsylvania has in excess of 3,000 public employee pension plans. Minnesota has somewhere in the neighborhood of 800 public employee pension plans. It's not a directly comparable proposition in that most of our pension plans are local volunteer fire pension plans. These are for emergency on-call employees. Sometimes the only compensation that a volunteer firefighter will receive is a pension at the end of service. It's typically in a lump sum based a certain dollar amount per year of service payable on or after age 50. So a goodly number of our pension plans by count are volunteer fire plans. They have very modest liabilities compared to the pension plans that cover regular employees and have a fairly modest asset base, but very important for the jurisdictions that they serve, and a very important tool in recruiting and retaining those public safety employees. I've prepared for you a set of handouts. I'm not going to go through them in any great deep detail. I'm just going to point out a few things. There's some information on the Pension Commission and how it operates. Something called the Principles of Pension Policy are starting on page 5 of the handout. The Pension Commission over time, and it's been in existence now for 40 plus years, has developed certain notions about what it will recommend favorably and what it won't, what sort of developments it wants to see in public pensions, and those are laid out in the principles. They become the basis for a lot of the commission identification of issues and discussion of issues when a pension bill is heard by the Pension Commission. You turn to page 9 of the handout. I've laid out for you Minnesota's various pension plans, and have broken these out by defined benefit plans and defined contribution plans. We have the largest number of Minnesota pension plans are defined benefit plans, and I've laid out the names of the various current plans, both statewide and local, in the top two-thirds, probably, of that page. We have a number of defined contribution plans. They are not as they do not cover as many active members as the defined benefit plans. Some of Minnesota defined benefit plans actually grew out of defined contribution plans in whole or in part. TRA, for instance, the statewide teachers plan, was a defined contribution plan until 1969. So some of these plans have changed over time. To give you some sense about what shape Minnesota's pension plans are, would have you turn to page 32 of the handout. There are 32 through 35 give you actuarial information and numerical counts and funding information for our statewide and major local public employee pension plans. The first page, page 32, is the three largest plans. MSRS General is the general employee pension plan of the state retirement system. It principally covers state employees and the non-teaching University of Minnesota employees, some metro government employees also. PERA General is the general employee plan that relates to primarily local government. This would be non-teaching school district employees and municipal and county employees who are not public safety employees. And then TRA is the statewide teachers plan, covers all teachers other than those covered by the Duluth or St. Paul teachers plan, and covers some but not all of the teaching Minsky folks. What this table gives you is a sense of the membership, the funding status, which is the second block of numbers, and then the what it takes to fund these plans. This particular table is put together based on the market value of assets. Currently, Minnesota keeps track of the funding situation of our pension plans on two bases: market value of assets, which is a generally accepted accounting principle, fair market value figure, and then something called the actuarial value of assets. Because on any given June 30th, and that's the date for these numbers, is June 30 of each year, there can be considerable volatility within a fairly short period of time, which is not necessarily on June 30 reflective of what the actual assets are worth on a long-term perspective. So there is something called the actuarial value of assets, and that's a five-year smoothing device that tries to take out some of the volatility in asset values. What it tends to do is, in down markets, it tends to delay the recognition of the adverse impact of a down market, and in an up market, it tends to delay the recognition of the positive changes that occur in an up market. Having started to come out of, apparently, the Great Recession, we're now seeing this break point where we haven't fully recognized the downside of the early part of the recession and have not started fully recognizing the upswing. But these are our market value of asset numbers. And what I've given you is a 2 years for each of the plans to give you some idea of the change. You take the three plans all together, which is the far right-hand set of columns. These plans have total pension liabilities of just under $50 billion, total assets on a market value of about $35.3 billion, leaving an unfunded of about $14.2 billion. We're 71.4% funded. Covered payroll and the annual benefits payable are laid out there, and then the rest of the table compares what the actuary has determined is the cost of the pension plan and compares that to the contribution rates that are currently in effect or were in effect during that plan year for the various plans. On the bottom of the page, it lays out a comparison whether the contributions are sufficient or deficient for the funding of the plan.
Mr. Martin, we have a question, if you don't mind. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Martin, over my first several years here, I was carrying some legislation that dealt with TRA, and I think I recall at that time that it was nearly fully funded back in the earlier part of the 2000s here. And then I'm just noting for the other members to consider, last year, 2 years ago, we did some yeoman's work and combined, I think, the Minneapolis Fund into TRA. Now I'm noticing this year you're showing 73, almost 74%. The funding ratio, it's down considerably. Will you talk about why that is, why the precipitous drop from earlier part of the decade, investments, overload on the system, or something like that?
Yes. Mr. Martin?
Yes. Yes. Madam Chair, what I think, yes, all these plans were better funded at one point in time. Many of our public employee pension plans were almost 100% or were 100% funded. TRA in 2001 was 105.8% funded. 1997, MSRS Correctional was 113% funded. PERA Police and Fire in 1998 was 134% funded. That was at the towards the end of a very large upmarket, a very large boom market. What you're seeing now is the reflection of, especially with these market value of asset figures, the impact of a very significant a recession, and the exact nature of that recession isn't clear, whether this is a V-shaped recession, a U-shaped recession, a W-shaped recession, or an L-shaped recession. How we're coming out of it isn't at all clear yet. We have, and Mr. Bicker will be here from the State Board of Investment to tell you about the more recent sets of our returns and what happened. But largely what you're seeing is the impact of our recession. If you turn to page 37 of the handout, it's not totally a function of the investment markets, but it has a lot to do with it. This table gives you a sense of how the unfunded accrued liabilities changed for these various plans from 2009 to 2010. So the first column of numbers, what's labeled here as the plan beginning unfunded, was the June 30, 2009 figure. And this shows you what the actuary has determined happened during that year to drive up or drive down the unfunded. And you can see that a good result, a gain is labeled here as in parentheses, and a bad result is not in parentheses. So this is a question of how the unfunded, the debt, increased or was reduced over time. And you can get a sense of the investment return column if you run down for the big three plans. That was an increase in the unfunded of almost $2.5 billion just between 2009 and 2010. Something else that happened, if you look at some the benefit plan amendments, if you run over about three quarters of the way across the page, there's a benefit plan amendments column. This is the 2010 omnibus pension bill and the changes that occurred in 2010, which reduced plan liabilities by reducing benefits for retirees and for active members, and changing the benefit plan for newly hired employees. And that was worth about $6 billion of a gain item. So this is not a static proposition. The investments were a large part of the overall funding problem that we are currently in. But there have been things that are positive, and one of them was the 2010 piece of legislation. This point, members, the page is available. I'd like to hand out one additional item. the related to the 2010 piece of legislation, the Pension Commission recommended in the 2010 Omnibus Pension Bill a number of changes which related to our Minnesota public pension plans. The large paper handout that I'm providing you is the quick summary of those changes that were approved by the 2010 legislature. It was a combination of things: contribution rate increases on the part of some of the plans, reductions in post-retirement adjustments in all plans, and other changes for other members, sometimes active members, by changing our retirement ages or vesting periods in other cases, for inactive members, changing the deferred annuities augmentation. So the impact of those changes are provided for you there. At this point, I should note that there is pending litigation related to some of the 2010 all legislation, and the positive impact that you saw on page 3037 may be mitigated or eliminated in large measure, depending upon the course of that piece of litigation. There is a class action suit by some PERA, MSRS, and TRA members in Ramsey County District Court challenging the post-retirement adjustments portion of that 2010 package. It's scheduled to be, motions on the litigation are scheduled to be heard in Judge Greg Johnson's courtroom on March 15th. And depending upon whether the state is successful in its motion to dismiss and whether the plaintiffs are successful in their motion for a directed verdict or whether it goes to a full trial, will have a lot to do with whether the gains that occurred and appear to have occurred in 2010 actually take place. If the state loses that piece of litigation, we go back to the full 2.5% post-retirement increases, including back payment of at least one payable on January 1, 2012. And a lot of the unfunded accrued liability that was offset by the 2010 legislation would be gone.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Representative Beard has a question.
Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, so who's being sued here, just to be clear? Because I remember this was a very carefully crafted bipartisan piece of legislation, as I recall, that kind of righted the ship a little bit. And we're being sued. Is the legislature being sued? The policy we put into play, or how's clarify for me?
No,
Mr. Martin,
Representative, the legislature is not a party to the lawsuit. MSRS and PERA and TRA, and I believe the governor are being sued. And it is over the 2010 piece of legislation that this body did fashion. So the executive branch is being sued by retirees of the three major pension plans.
I'm
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I'm speechless almost over. I know we pass it and they execute it, but if we're trying to do the right thing and make the funds whole or more stable, I'm flabbergasted that we're being sued or that somebody's being sued for doing what I think we asked them to do. Yeah, apparently I'm missing something, or maybe I'm not missing something, which just frightens me. So I'll just sit here quietly and contemplate that, I guess, unless somebody else can help me be smarter about this.
Do you have a comment on that, Mr. Barton? If not, please proceed.
I'll proceed. You will be hearing from the three fund directors, three major plans, and you may want to have them. They're more actively engaged in the litigation. I'm watching it off from afar, as you are, and it's not fully settled law in the state of Minnesota what latitude the legislature has to adversely modify pension benefits. And that's clearly what the 2010 legislature did. We reduced benefits. And whether the agreement of representatives of the group can bind all of the group is an open matter in this state. So members, page 32 gives you a sense of the current shape, perhaps the worst case scenario shape of the of Minnesota Pension Fund funding for the major statewide plan. In page 33, there's some information about the statewide public safety plans. 34 is what we call the specialty plans. This is largely the judges is the only active fund there. There's a remnant of the pre 97 legislative plan there, and the remnant of the old constitutional officers plan there, but it's the largest piece of that action is the judges plan. And then the first class city plans, we have two of the the original first-class city teacher pension funds still in existence. The Duluth Teachers Plan, which is the DTRFA, and listed in the columns on page 35. The St. Paul Teachers Plan in the middle, and then also MRF is here. This is the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. The Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund was consolidated in a full consolidation into the statewide TRA in 2006, as Representative Beard commented. In 2010, as part of the omnibus pension bill, MRF was also consolidated on an administrative basis with PERA. This means that PERA operates the pension plan. There's no longer a freestanding administration or investment function performed by anyone in Minneapolis. The benefit plan stays essentially the same, with the exception that the retirees get the same post-retirement increases as PERA does. But otherwise, the benefit plan stays the same. MRF had been closed to new entrants in 1977 or 78. And so you can see that there is a very small active population. We're less than 150 active members out of a plan that covers 4,600 people. So it's a plan that was phasing out, and that was one of its one of the problems was the combination of phasing out and the recession. MRF was virtually 100% funded, right on the cusp of the start of the Great Recession, and dropped precipitously. And because there are very few active members and any very short period of time in which to amortize the unfunded in that plan, started producing very large costs and was in very great deal of difficulty. Minneapolis is still the primary guarantor or funder of those benefits, but administered by PERA. I had mentioned briefly the actuarial value of assets versus market value of assets, and if you can turn to page 31 of your handouts for the big three, I can give you some sense of what that means as a practical matter currently. This table is very similar to the ones I was just showing you, but it does break out two different sets of funding ratio numbers. These are in items C and D. C is the actuarial value of assets. D is the market value of assets. We were talking in the previous tables about a market value related unfunded of about $14 billion. If you look at the actuarial value of assets up on and the funding ratio and unfunded there, C3 in this table, that looks like it's a better circumstance. It's 10.1 billion unfunded. So if you use a smoothing device on the assets, you get better looking results. Whether the smoothing is smoothing in the right direction. Is if the delay in recognizing the full impact of the market value declines that have recently occurred is a correct thing, then one can argue that the $10 billion is a better figure to be looking at long term than the $14 billion, which is something of a sky is falling worst case scenario. But this gives you that sense about what the difference is. The rest of the packet that I have for you is largely informational items related to our Minnesota public pension plans. If you're interested in the what the plan membership looks like, starting on page 19, I've got some basic demographic information, how many people are covered, average salaries, average age, average length of service over a long period of time, 1985 to 2010. And that'll give you some flavor about what the character and nature of Minnesota public plan members are. With that, I would happy to answer questions and to leave time for the rest of the presentations.
Thank you, Mr. Martin and members. These gentlemen were kind enough to also do a presentation this morning for state government finance, and I understand that it went over quite a bit. So I'm going to try to have this portion wrapped up in the next 12, 15 minutes, something like that. I am wondering, kind of at a high level, if you could talk a little bit more about the unfunded liabilities, the ratio of where we're at, the percentage of, and what does that actually mean in comparison to other states? I'm just trying to get a sense, especially for perhaps new members to the legislature. I was looking at page 32 in particular and trying to get a handle on, you know, the funding ratio, and MSRS is 75% and PARA 66%. How desperate of a situation is that? Where are we at? And then also, maybe you could explain the deficiency in the bottom column and how that relates. Because the deficiency, for example, in MSRS says 3.9%, while the funding ratio is 75%. And if you can explain how those two numbers interrelate, that would be helpful. And then perhaps after that, maybe we'll have time for just a couple of member questions.
Yes, Madam Chair. The analogy is not perfect, but it's something like a house mortgage versus your monthly mortgage payment. Your house mortgage is the unfunded. That's the amount that you have left due and owing on your house. And unless the bank wants to take it in a shorter period of time, you have a considerable length of time to pay off that mortgage. Exactly how much equity you have in your house is not terribly critical. For a pension plan, it can be critical if you have a declining active membership and a large retiree membership, where all those benefits are going to be paid over a relatively short future period. But for plans like the plans on page 30, 32, which are large plans, large memberships, not all about to retire in the next year or two, not all going to become benefit pay status folk, it's less critical to be any particular percent funded, but you ought to be improving. And what perhaps is more critical is the sufficiency numbers or insufficiency numbers down in the bottom of the page, because this is your monthly mortgage payment, and all of these plans have the problem of we're not paying off the entire mortgage, so that there is going to be a day of reckoning in the future unless either the assets improve, which Mr. Bicker could tell us about. The numbers on page 32 are, in some cases, the worst-case scenario. This is the market value of assets as of June 30, 2010, which was not a real rosy point in time. So there will be a recovery, presumably, and that recovery will rebound these assets to some significant extent. So this is the worst-case scenario, as it were, shortfall in the monthly mortgage payment. But that I'm always more troubled by those shortfalls in the contribution rates, because the contribution rates are—they're not the during the active working lifetime. They are the primary money being put into the pension plan for any given member. but investments ultimately generate 60 or 70% of the actual benefit payout. Putting away money from year one, day one of an active member's career, and investing that money and earning interest on it will produce the bulk of the money that actually will be paid out to that member when that member chooses to retire. If you don't put the money away in the early stages, you can't earn investment income and money that's not there. So to the extent that we've got shortfalls, we have fairly long amortization periods for virtually all of these plans. So this is the early stage of funding for these benefits. And if we don't get the contribution rates a little closer to where they ought to be, either by in a rebound in the assets, making the unfunded smaller. If you look up, there's a in the, about two-thirds of the way down the page, there are two numbers, the normal cost and expenses number and the amortization number. The amortization relates to that unfunded pension liability. It's the debt service on that unfunded. The normal cost is what the benefit plan costs for active members today without paying any attention to any unfunded. If we were to create this plan new and fresh, we would only have to put in normal costs and expenses if we didn't have any carryover past funding problems. If you look at the comparison between the normal costs and expenses versus the amortization contribution requirement, our amortization contribution requirements are very, very high because of that large unfunded. If the funding rebounds, some or all of that goes away. And these plans are not that expensive absent that unfunded, which is largely a measure of whether the investment markets are recovered or not. So there's no reason per se to panic at this stage with these level of deficiencies. They are worth closely monitoring. A couple of years from now, if we're still in this sort of situation, there would be reason for having greater contributions, absolutely. Right now, there are some contribution increases that are scheduled as a result of the 2010 legislation, and we are still waiting to see what the trend line will be for this our recovery. Depending upon how those things go in the next couple of years, I would be more concerned if it looks akin to this a couple years hence.
Members have any questions? Mr. Burke, did you have anything to add in your testimony?
Madam Chairman, no. No, I don't.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering how you've done this in a little over half an hour when it took an hour the last hour, the last committee.
Mr. Martin.
Practice made it perfect.
Thank you so much for your testimony. On the agenda next, we have Mary Vanek, Executive Director of PERA. Oh, I guess not. You don't look
Chair,
like Mary.
We changed things. Oh. Neither of us are Mary Vanek.
Okay.
Mary had a bad day.
Yeah.
Mr. Bergstrom, will you be going first then?
Actually, Mr. Bicker.
Okay. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Bicker, please proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the Director of the State Investment Board. And I'd like to give you a very brief review of the State Board of Investment and respond to any questions you have. The first chart is a review of the State Board. The State Board runs the pension-related assets of all the statewide funds. We also invest the funds of a number of other entities throughout state government. The board is comprised of the governor, the state auditor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state, and this is established by the Constitution. And the board has an advisory council that is comprised of 17 members, 10 of which are from the local investment community. These are people who run some of the big private pension plans throughout the state of Minnesota. The next slide is our asset allocation. This is the asset allocation that we have for the retirement-related assets. You can see it's a relatively aggressive long-term asset allocation. We have 45% in domestic equities, 15% in international equities, 18% in bonds, and 20% in alternative investments. Returns. The State Board of Investments returns are very much like a lot of other organizations. We've had some good years and we've had some bad years. Most recently, the last fiscal year, which ended on June 30th of 2010, we were up 15.2. But you can see, as you're all well aware of, during the recession, the markets experienced some very troubling times. But I think the most important item that I would like to bring across to you all is that we are long-term investors. Pensions are 30, 40-year time horizon issues. And you can see that over the last 25 years, and actually since 1-1 of 80, which is approximately 31 years, we have compounded at 9%+. And over that period of time, the assumed rates of return for the retirement systems have been approximately 8.5%. That is the big issue. Everybody's worried about whether we can make money or not make money. Over long periods of time, we have made sufficient returns to fund the pension plans. Also, and I hate to be short-term oriented, but also on the bottom of that slide, you can see that for the first 6 months of this fiscal year, we're up over 16%. So, although we've gone through some very hard economic times, the markets have corrected, or at least hopefully are in the process of correcting and will continue to correct. The last slide that I will go over is, again, Mr. Martin made some statements of this also, and that is that the investment component is critical in the retirement programs. The investment component has returned approximately two-thirds of all the assets that are in the plans to support pensions. So, Madam Chair and members, that's a very quick review of the State Investment Board, and I'll stand for any questions you may have.
You don't want to go through the rest of it, or just want to take
they questions? Will do that.
Do members have questions? Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, I don't have a question. I guess I just want. I wonder if Mr. Bicker could comment further on the 8.5% return assumption and what that means in terms of long-term investment volatility and making short-term investment decisions.
I think that's a good question, Representative Winkler, and it seems a little optimistic to me, but maybe you could comment on that.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, first I commend Representative Winkler for going through this for the second time. the 8.5% number is a number that will be debated among a number of people. I always go back when you talk about 8.5, but we were sitting here 10, 11 years ago, 1999, 1998, they asked you what your assumed rate of return is. You'd say 10, 12, no problem. And then in 2002, it would have been 4. And then in 2005 and early 6, it would have been back to 9 or 10. And today we're saying, well, you can't make 3. It's very time dependent. And what we are doing here in the investment of pension-related assets is looking at these issues over very, very long periods of time. And over long periods of time, the state of Minnesota has returned over 9%. As Representative Winkler is talking about, though, is that if we're going to make 8.5%, you have to have an investment program that has equities in it and therefore will have volatility. We're going to have good years, we're going to have bad years. And what I would strongly suggest is that when you have a volatile portfolio, to make an 8.5% return over a long periods of time, you have to be very cognizant of that in the sense of making decisions, and therefore you can't react very quickly to negative numbers, or you shouldn't react quickly to positive numbers. We expect standard deviations. We expect standard deviations of, our assumed rate of return is in statute 8.5%. Our asset allocation expected return is slightly under 9. We have a standard deviation of over 9. So therefore, we expect anywhere on, one standard deviation, two-thirds of the time, you expect to be around 0 or plus 15 or 16. So when you have a 0 year or a negative year, you don't panic. It's expected. But over a long period of time, 30-plus years, with pension policy properly constructed, the fund should be very financially viable. But you have to, because of the equity component, also take that into consideration in your decisions as it relates to the plan over short-term periods.
Any other members, questions? Are we ready to move on to Mr. Bergstrom then? Please proceed, Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. You'll hear a lot of acronyms over time. We're MSRS, very creative, Minnesota State Retirement System, but you'll get used to the acronyms. I've been the director since 1992. Prior to that, I worked 8 years at the Public Employees Retirement Association. I'd like to just start out today with a very brief overview, and we would like to visit each of you on a one-on-one basis to kind of go over more detail, if that's all right, or appear back and do that. But feel free to ask any questions. The Minnesota State Retirement System covers state employees, University of Minnesota non-faculty employees, Metropolitan Council employees, non-faculty MinSCU employees, and then some other smaller groups. We are governed by an 11-member board. We have four elected from our general plan, three governor appointees. And you can see that we have elected State Patrol Correctional and a transit union member. In total assets, we have $13 billion, $9.1 billion for our mandatory retirement plans, and $3.9 for our supplementary retirement plans. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a few seconds. Just to put into context our membership, the size, from a mandatory retirement plan, we are the smallest of the three statewide plans. I'll just go across the top and then let you read down the bottom. Just talk briefly about this. Our general plan as of June 30th of 2010 had $7.7 billion. We have 48,494 active participants, 28,000 benefit recipients, and we've got about a little over 15,000 people who have left state government that someday will be eligible to collect monthly benefits. That's what we call deferred members. So they aren't collecting today. They're no longer state employees, but had enough years of service to collect. I would like to point out that 7.7, I looked this morning, has grown to 8.7 because of the strong investment return that we've had since July 1. So we've seen, again, a dramatic increase in the assets because of the State Board of Investment investing. You can see the general plan is by far our largest plan. I'll touch on a couple of other plans just to highlight. Legislators' plans always gets interest. They close that to new elected officials in 1997. Since then, anybody elected after that is in our unclassified plan. Our unclassified plan is a defined contribution plan. You I'll call you employees, as an elected official, contribute 5%, and the state contributes 6%. Most of your employees are in the unclassified plan as well. I would say that the employees do have an option to switch to the general plan if they so choose. So they actually have kind of both type benefits. And you can see that we have about 1,400 active members in our unclassified plan, and about 1,800 people have just left their money in and continue to invest it with us. I'd like to then move just quickly to our supplementary plans. We administer the deferred compensation plan that is available not only to state employees, it's available to city, county, school employees. In essence, every public employee in the state can contribute. It's the fifth largest plan in the country. It has $3.5 billion of assets with about 80,000 participants. Our healthcare savings plan is available to all employers in the state of Minnesota, and that is something that the employers choose on whether or not to participate. In a lot of those cases, it's just employee money going into it. We have about 63,000 people in that plan. We also administer a small plan for Hennepin County as well. The biggest plan that MSRS administers is the general plan, and I'll talk a little bit about actuarial funding and market value funding. As Mr. Martin already talked about, you see less volatility on the actuarial side. You can see that we were 93.7% funded in 2007, and in 2010 we were at 87.3%. You'll see that it's a much gentler ups and downs. If you go over to the right and look at market value, where our market value in 2007, so four short years ago, MSRS general plan was knocking on the door of 100% funding. We were at 98.7. That would follow an 18.3% return. Then in 2008, we lost 5%. 2009, we lost an 18.8, which dropped us down to 65.6. The 15% return on a market value for June 30th of 2010 increased us to 75. If I were to do this today, based on the 16% return, we'd be in the 83% range. So you can see the market had a huge impact on our funding. The current contribution rates to our general employees retirement plan is 5%. The employer contribution is 5%. Nationally, the average contribution for employees is 5%. The average contribution for employers is 9.4%. So MSRS's employer contribution is considerably less than we see in most states.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, you had just emphasized what I wanted to emphasize, and I was in the last committee as well, but just so it's clear, our employer, that is government contribution, that's kicked in here, is lower than most states, right?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, absolutely.
Okay, and do you have some outliers for us in terms of who some of the higher ones are, what their percentages are, not the averages, but give us an example of some other states and what they kick in versus what we kick in.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, some states paid nothing, which got them into trouble. Illinois is a good example. You've been reading a lot about that. They actually stopped paying in when they should have. I can get you the detail on that. I think the highest is probably in the 12, 13, 14% range of a similar situated plan. But we are significantly more cost effective than most other states.
Mr. Bergstrom, what state would give 12 to 13%, just out of curiosity? Do you know that one?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to give you that. I have a chart. I don't know it off the top of my head, but
Representative Winkler guessed Texas, and I'm going to be betting him $10 that it's not Texas. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, I have enough trouble remembering MSRS, let alone what's going on in other states. But I will provide you with that information. And the other thing I want to just highlight here is MSRS contributions have been very stable over time. If you go back to the early 80s, we were at 4% employee and 4% employer. In the last few years, we've tailed that up. But we have been a very stable organization for a long period of time. We do have a couple of public safety plans that are bigger as well, the correctional plan. I'll look at the market value there. They were 84% funded at one point in 2007. Mr. Martin explained that this plan was well over 100%, not about 10 years prior to that. We have now climbed on a market value to 61.7%. The employee contribution is 8.6%, and the employer contribution is 12.1%. Public safety plans generally have full retirement at 55, and that's why you'll see a higher contribution rate for that. The state's kind of policy on funding, our general plan is a 50-50 split. For the public safety plans, it's generally 40% employee and 60% employer. That's kind of the rule of thumb that the Pension Commission uses. Our Minnesota State Patrol plan was in 2007 96.3%. That dropped to 62, is back up to 71.5. That plan was hit particularly hard because it has a very large liability on the retiree side. It has a lot of retirees compared to active members, and therefore when the market dropped and you have a small group of employees paying in, That plan was hit particularly hard. The current employee contribution rate for that plan is 10.4 and 15.6. Last year in the sustainability bill that we passed, that was the only plan that MSRS asked for contribution rate increases. The employee contribution rates on July 1 of this year are going to go up 2%, and the employer contribution rate is going up 3%. For the employer, I believe that amounted to about $1.7 million per year. With our other plans, the board did not raise contribution rates for the other retirement plans.
Mr. Bergstrom, can we pause for a question from Representative Beard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, I'm noticing on the State Patrol, some of those participants are not covered by Social Security. And on a couple of these other plans, I don't see that. I know when we did the Minneapolis teachers, there was a problem with some of them were not covered by Social Security as well. Could you just maybe shed a little light on what we're dealing with here? Are the new patrol members in state Social Security and so on and so forth?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, they do not contribute to Social Security. Current troopers, regardless of when they were hired, they do contribute to the Medicare piece, but that's why you'll see a higher contribution rate, because 6.2% on both the employee and employer side goes for retirement on Social Security. So when you do the comparison, it looks a lot higher here. Our correctional plan is covered by Social Security. Our general plan is. The only other two plans that were not covered by Social Security were legislators and elective officers.
Thank you. Mr. Bergstrom, you just gave some numbers for the employee and employer contributions for the State Patrol, and I'm wondering if you could mention those again, and also how does that compare to other states generally?
Madam Chair, the 10.4 is going to rise to 12.4, and the 15.6 is going to rise to 18.6. I don't have as many statistics on other public safety plans, but I can get you from that. You know, the organization that we belong to looks a lot at the bigger plans. I don't think it's out of line, but it is probably higher than some states because of the drop in the funding of that program.
Okay, thank you.
I can try to get you the more detail.
I would be curious. It seems a little high, but I'd be curious. It's a different type of fund. So go ahead.
And Madam Chair, again, if you take the 6.6 off of there that they're not paying into Social Security, that does make a difference as well. What reform we passed in 2010, and you talked a little bit about the lawsuit, and I can't give a lot of detail, but I would like to say that our reform package was supported by all of the state unions, AFSCME, middle management, MAPE. Every union that we had supported the change. Our retiree organization as well supported the change. So where a handful of retirees are filing a lawsuit, it was backed by over 8,000 members of our Minnesota Retired State Employees Association and our unions. What we did last year is we wanted to slow the growth of our liabilities, and that is what we accomplished. We lowered our future increases to our retirees to 2% until we reached 90% funded on a market value. The State Patrol, because of the funding situation that they were in, we lowered it to 1.5%. For those people that have left state government and someday will collect, we lowered the amount that they will grow. Under existing law, they get 3% until 55 and then 5% thereafter. We changed that to 2%. We did not ask for any contribution rates for the general plan or the correctional plan, and that shows the employee and employer contribution rate for the State Patrol plan. We increased the vesting period from 3 years to 5 years in all of our plans. The correctional folks actually came to us and recommended a graded vesting from or a higher vesting period because of the career nature of their job, and they will become a graded vesting, half vested at 5 years, fully vested at 10 years. The refund that we pay to people who have left state government and pull their money out, effective July 1 of 2011, we lowered that from 6% to 4%. We didn't take away any of the interest accrued to date. It's all going prospectively from there. So any of these adjustments were prospective interest. The value of that, the lowering of our liabilities for the general plan, was $650 million. The correctional plan was $45 million and the state patrol $62 million. So the law, in effect, lowered the growth of our liabilities, then fueled by the strong investment return, what we put in place is working, and we are seeing the results of that. So it's been a fairly substantial, dramatic turnaround when it comes to pension liabilities to turn things around that quickly. Can't say that we're out of the woods yet. We have a ways to go. We're not satisfied with 83% funded. We need to move back. We are not asking for major changes this year. We are looking at holding the course and seeing what happens. So we are not introducing any major legislation this year.
Any questions, members? Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair?
Oh, thank you, Representative Winkler. Go ahead.
I just would like to return to one point on slide 4, page 4, I guess, bottom slide, and wonder if Mr. Bergstrom could give a comparison on where Minnesota is and its underfunding compared to other states and what some of the outliers might be there as well.
Mr. Bergstrom?
I'm sorry, on which?
It's slide 8, I guess. It's okay. On our pack at page 4.
Okay. Slide 8. The results that I have are mostly, again, when we get the national comparisons and are on an actuarial value. And as of 2009, MSRS on an actuarial funding value was 85.9. That is about 6% higher than the typical funding average in other states. And the other thing that you will see unique to Minnesota, because of the leadership that the legislature showed, we actually our unfunded or our actuarial value went up to 87.3%, where other states will not have that because most of them did not make the changes or only change future employees, so the difference will be greater. So there is about a 6% difference in the average there from where we were 85% down to more of the 79-80%.
Representative Winkler, a follow-up?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just because we hear a lot of dire predictions about the state of public pensions, and people often like to mention states like Illinois and New Jersey, sometimes California. I wonder if you could give us just a flavor of what those states' unfunded liability is and compare that to Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I don't have the numbers, but much higher. I think Illinois is in the 50% range on an actuarial basis. New Jersey, what has happened in those states is they have not made contributions to their pension plan. And in some states, in Illinois' case, they actually borrowed money to make contributions to their retirement plan, and it's coming back to bite them. New Jersey just passed a law that said that requires the employers to pay their full need, but they phased it in over 7 years. So this year they only have to pay 1/7 of what's required. So I think what we see in Minnesota is that, you know, you get excited when you see the drop like we have. It certainly was not comfortable for us in our business either. But one thing Minnesota has done over time is has done a very good job of funding pensions. At times we're over 100% funded, and we have responded quickly. And I think that's the difference between Minnesota and other states. And I think you, as a body, should be complimented for that.
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, in light of repetitive questions about how we're doing compared to the national or, you know, other comparisons, is it possible to generate a chart that shows our portfolio return and then the average U.S. with a min-max, you know, range on it, you know, something that will help answer more in general and offline provide us that type of chart?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, we'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Let's take one more question from Representative Simon, and then I think we'll move on to Mary Vanek. Representative Simon.
And this came up in the previous committee, too, but just so we can have a little discussion about it here. When it comes to the employer contribution, the generosity of the employer contribution, can you make any general statements as to a comparison with the private sector?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, the most typical contribution to a 401k plan is a 3% match. That's overall the biggest. Then on top of that, there's often a profit sharing plan that typically is in the 3-4% range. So when you add the two together, generally 6-7% if those that have a profit sharing plan. I will say that half of the employers, private employers in the United States right now, offer no pension plan, no 401k, no savings retirement plan whatsoever, and that's going to be a concern going forward. But the larger employers who do pay 3% and then a profit sharing plan is different.
Just think.
Follow up, Madam Chair. So as I'm understanding,
Senator Simon,
thank you, Madam Chair. If you add up profit sharing plus pension, that's at about 7%, and we in Minnesota are contributing 5%. So on that basis, what we often hear about how much more generous the public pensions are, no one in the private sector would ever get something that's generous. Based on those indicia, that's not true, right?
Madam Chair, Representative
Simon, Mr. Bergstrom.
That's absolutely correct.
I have a follow-up question on that, though. You probably don't have the number on this because it's a public or a private sector question, but the profit sharing plan, do you know how typical that is when you talk about adding 3-4% in profit sharing? Is that do you know what percentage of private sector jobs offer that? Because I would guess it's not the largest portion.
Madam Chair, I would guess in the last few years, probably not with the economy, but I can provide you with the study that we use if you would like. I don't have the answer to that, but I do have a study that I use to look at private pension plans.
That would be helpful because I think that would be more of an apples-to-apples comparison if we had a good number on that. Any more burning questions? If not, we can move on to Mary Vanek. Okay. Oh, Representative Beard, one quick question.
Coming, just a comment for our edification. It kind of takes off Representative Simon's comment. One of the reasons I asked about Social Security and who was eligible and who wasn't is because many of the pension plans that started around the state back in the day, one of the things they could do would be opt out of Social Security. the feeling being, or the plan, I guess, was that those monies that wouldn't then be going to the federal program would be invested by local folks at a higher rate of return and so on and so forth. So just to kind of close the loop on the Minneapolis fix, when Representatives Osment and Thiessen helped cobble that together a couple years ago, one of the things we were dealing with the Minneapolis retired teachers who had a much higher monthly payout was that was the only thing they had. They had no Social Security. They were not eligible for Social Security. And so we kind of had to fix that mess and roll them into TRA. But now going forward, I think everybody since 87 or something like that is in Social Security as well as in a state pension program, whether it's defined contribution or defined benefit. Is immaterial, but just so the members realize that there were some veteran state employees who were not eligible for Social Security. They did it by choice, and when we're cleaning up this mess, we kind of have to kind of be cognizant of that, that if we cut some of these benefits back too far, they have nothing else to fall back on. So it just is what it is, and I thought it'd be helpful just for members to bear that in mind.
Thank you, Representative Beard. We'll start with Mary Vanek, the Executive Director of PARA.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Mary Vanek. I've been the Director of PARA for the last 14 years. I've been with the system for 36, so I've seen the best of times and some of the more difficult times. PERA has grown substantially in membership. We have all county, city, and non-teaching school district employees. We have roughly 158,000 active members total in all three defined benefit plans that we govern. We have an 11-member board. Five of our members are elected by the membership, three to represent the general plan, one to represent the police and fire plan, and one to represent retirees. Five of our members are appointed by the governor, one to represent cities, one counties, one school districts, one the general public, and another retiree representative. And then we also have the state auditor sitting on our board, or a designee of the state auditor. So 11 members govern us. We have total assets as of June 30th of $16.9 billion under our administration. And of course, as Mr. Bergstrom mentioned with the returns recently, that's grown, and we can only hope that it stays in place. This is a breakdown of the plans that we administer. Our general plan is our largest. That's where we have about 140,000 active members and about 68,500 benefit recipients, and another 45,000 individuals who have left the system but earned a right to a pension. And so when they reach eligible age, they will we will contact them and start paying them their benefits. Police and fire assets, $4.4 billion, 11,000 members, 7,500 benefit recipients, and another 1,300 folks who will eventually get a pension. Correctional, that plan was just created by the legislature in 1999. It is local county correctional facility jailers. It's very limited in who it covers. It's got about $211 million, 3,500 active members, 441 benefit recipients, and again, another 1,900 folks who are deferred. We also have a defined contribution plan that we administer, and that's primarily with local government elected officials. There are some ambulance service personnel who are eligible. Doctors in local government hospitals can opt to participate in this plan rather than our defined benefit. We have 32 million under management, 7,200 folks. About 4,500 of those are currently contributing. The rest of them have accounts with us and are still investing through the state board supplemental plans. That's where they're investing. And then as of June 30th of this 2010, the legislature asked us to take over administration of the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. It is not merged with us. It is a separate account within PERA's administration. It has assets of about $844 million, 143 active members, and 4,300 benefit recipients, with about 100 folks eligible for benefits. Mr. Bergstrom talked to you about how we have maintained relatively stable funding in Minnesota over the years. PERA had some significant challenges. Those of you who've been in the legislature for the last decade have seen us several times before you with corrections and modifications we were making to our programs. And so when 2007 rolled around, we were feeling pretty good. With the support we had of the legislature, we had our plans in pretty good shape. We were in the 70 percentile, 73% actuarial, 77% market value funded in 2007. And that was not as good as our sister systems. However, our contributions were right where they needed to be. So we were on track to go forward. And then the market declined in 08 and 09 on the right-hand set of charts, the market value charts. Was very, of course, troubling to the Pension Commission, to the legislature, and to our board. So we took some pretty significant action and came before you last year with the bill that, yes, we have some challenges with the lawsuit, but we are we're in good shape if we prevail on those changes. The contribution rate history in PERA is interesting, PERA General. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of details, but I can tell you this much. In 1984, we were 78% funded. And the State Department of Finance suggested that our contributions by employers were more than they needed to be. So they took away 1.25% of pay of our contribution rates. They lowered our employer rate when we were only 78% funded. And while the other systems got to 100% funding, we only got to 90 in 1999. And a lot of that had to do with some assumptions that were made about how much we needed in contributions. And so we have been struggling going forward. Our contribution rates currently are 6.25% from employees and 7.25% from employers. So our employee in a general plan covered by Social Security like ours, paying a little bit more than the average employee in the country, and our employers are paying still 7.25, still a little under what the average employer contribution would be for a plan like ours. The police and fire fund was very well funded.
Ms. Bennett, could you just maybe, as long as you're on that section, still talk a little bit about the merger, the MRF and PERA merger, and how that's going, giving a little update?
Sure. The Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund is being administered by us. They are not merged into our plan. So the numbers that appear here are strictly our general plan. The Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund is about 66% funded. The contributions are based upon what the additional, there's only 143 people contributing. So if we talk about what's being contributed as an employee and employer contribution rate, it doesn't mean a lot because there are additional contributions that are being made through the employers, the City of Minneapolis, the school district, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, Hennepin County, Minsku, a little bit, and then the contributions being made by the state of Minnesota to get that plan, to make sure that the plan has adequate assets to ensure that those benefits can be paid to those people.
Thank you. So it's going well?
The transition went fine. We got them merged into our system for benefit payments as of January 1st, so they're getting paid through a normal process with us. I haven't heard any complaints from the participants of MRF. They seem to be comfortable with the switchover. We actually brought one staff person over to our office. We had an open position and brought her on board. The two people written into statute who were allowed to come and become para staff did not join us. They chose not to. But the one person that did is the benefits administrator, and she is, I think she's the comfort, you know, point person for the MRF members. But it's worked very well.
Representative Beard, you have a question on this too?
I do, yes. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me about this. But to be clear, the MRF employees are going forward, are they still enrolling new Minneapolis employees in that plan, or are they coming under PERA?
Ms. Panic.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, the new employees of Minneapolis have been enrolled in PERA since 1978.
Okay. And there is, Madam
Representative
Chair,
Beard,
as I understand, from the general fund, there is a contribution made to that fund. It's in some fashion. The number $70 million sticks in my mind, but I don't remember why. Because there aren't enough contributions coming to cover the people who are actually retired on that plan now, if I'm not mistaken. Can you remind us about what that contribution is from the rest of the state to keep that whole?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I knew you were going to ask me this one. The $70 million was the annual total contribution that at one point within the last year and a half was determined is what was needed to adequately fund the plan. Where it landed was that the state's already contributing $9 million, and I believe there's another $15 million added on to that. Okay. And that additional contribution starts in fiscal 2012. So the $9 million has been in statute for quite some time, or has been part of the budgeting process for quite some time. The additional contribution from the state starts in fiscal 2012, so after June 30th of 2012.
Ms. Vanek, could you refresh my memory on what the additional contribution from Minneapolis is?
Madam Chair, I don't remember all the breakdowns, but I'll certainly get it to you, because there's some from Minneapolis, some from the school districts, from Minsku and Hennepin County, and the Airports Commission. They all have a piece of it, and it was a percentage amount based upon a share, an unfunded balance as of last June 30th. So they split it up on a percentage basis of their share of it. So I don't remember the exact numbers, but I do know that as part of the legislation this year, there was both a cap and a floor on what the contribution would be, so that the state's contribution was over and above whatever that cap and floor. So if the markets did really well and the local employer's contribution dropped significantly, that they would at least have to contribute a base amount. And if the unfunded, if the markets did not so well, and there was a huge increase in the unfunded liabilities, then there was a cap on how much the employers would have to contribute each year, just so that they had a budgeting tool available to them. And I apologize, I don't have all the numbers up in my head yet, and I will get those to you.
Thank you. That would be helpful information. And if you want to proceed, Ms. Vanek,
absolutely.
Please do. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Nelson had a question as well.
Thank
Representative
you.
Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Vanek, I guess I serve on the Pension Commission, or I have served on the Pension Commission in the past, so I see a lot of the stuff. But as a, just a general point on information, the MRF pensions are also are not coordinated so that they do not, those people do not get Social Security. Is that correct?
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, that's correct.
And the other thing I do, Madam Chair, is during my campaign this last year and after we passed the legislation, I've got many calls from people that were in MRF that are very happy with what's been done there. They're, because we basically we strengthened those pensions so they didn't lose their money. Because, again, if they if that one went out of business, those people would be left with nothing.
Please proceed, Ms. Vanek.
Okay. The next fund is our Police and Fire Fund. The Police and Fire Fund was, I think Mr. I can't remember if Mr. Martin mentioned it at this meeting or the previous meeting, but at one point in time, the Police and Fire Fund was 134% funded. And in 1999, I recall that it was about 126% funded. In 1999, the contributions were rolled back significantly. They were lowered because we were so well funded, with the idea that the extra money sitting in the fund would help cover the cost of the pension program. We did warn at that time if we had any market losses that it would catch up with us, and it certainly did. That along with benefit improvements that have been made to that program. So on the market value side of this equation, in 2007 we were 97.5% funded. With the market drop by 2009, we were 63.6% funded, and we're back up just about 75% funded. You can see below that consistently the contributions were 20%, 8% from members, 12% from employers. They were dropped slightly because the plan was well funded back in 93, 94. But because it continued to grow in value because of the strong markets, the contributions were reduced again substantially to 15.5% of payroll. And they are now back up to 24% of payroll, and that is not enough. That is a plan that we're going to have to take a look at again. They are not covered by Social Security under state law. Law enforcement and firefighters in salaried positions are not covered by Social Security. So this is their pension program. And we will continue to monitor that, but we have made good improvement in with respect to the changes made in the 2010 bill. As I mentioned earlier, the correctional plan was just created by the legislature in 1999. It has consistently maintained pretty solid funding. Of course, the market did a job on it also. We went from 107% funded in 2007 to about 73% in 2009. We are back up to almost 85% funded, and that was as of June 30th. And the contribution for this plan has remained stable at 5.83 by the employee and 8.75 by the employer. There is a policy, it is written into PARA's police and fire plan, and I don't know if it's written into the other plans, but generally in Minnesota, the decision was made that public safety plans would be funded with the employee picking up 40% of the required contribution and the employer picking up the other 60%. So you will see in our correctional plans, in our police and fire plan, in the state patrol plan, that the contribution rates are split, and it's always the employee picks up 40%, the employer picks up 60%. Again, Mr. Martin brought to your attention the fact that we are being sued over the COLA changes. Our attorneys are working on it. We failed to let Mr. Martin know that the hearing has been moved to March 22nd at 9:30 in Ramsey County District Court. But what came out of our board and the recommendation to the legislature is we lowered our annual adjustments to retirees to 1%. The police and fire plan members will receive CPI up to 1.5% beginning in 2013. Again, they don't have Social Security, so that was a compromise that we reached with them, that this is their only benefit payment. And the correctional plan, again, 1% until we get to 90% funded. We changed the interest we'll pay on people who are no longer in the system but are, their benefits are waiting to be paid. We have contribution rate increases, slight ones, 0.5% each, shared equally in the general plan and shared on the 40-60 split in the police and fire plan. No contributions for correctional. Vesting was changed to 5 years in our general plan, and actually graded vesting, and this was a recommendation of the police and fire membership, that they would be 50% vested after 5 years of service and 100% vested after 10, and it graduates up in between those two. And that was recommended by our police and fire membership for all new enrollees as of July 1st of 2010, and that also applies to correctional. And at the bottom, you can see that we reduced our unfunded liabilities in the general by a projected $2.8 billion, in our police and fire by $625 million, correctional $15 million, and along with the investment returns, we recovered about a little over $3.6 billion in our costs between investment returns and the changes made in the pension bill.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. I just wanted to go back, if I could, to page 8, slide 15. You gave us some helpful history about how and why the employee contribution went down in the late 90s for the police and fire. Mm-hmm. And the stakes are higher for these folks because they're not covered by Social Security. So a question I've always had, I've never been on the Pension Commission, who makes those kinds of governance decisions? Obviously, it depends on what the Pension Commission does, on what we in the legislature do. But in terms of at the beginning of a legislative session, say in the late 90s or early 2000s, the decision was made to go ahead and let's push for a lower contribution, for example. Could you describe that a little bit? That's something I've never fully understood.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon. In this particular case, because the plan had been over 100% funded for so long, and the contributions continuing to come in and fuel it, there was concern about, you know, the cost of the plan when the additional assets were seen as an opportunity to increase benefits. So we had some very frank discussions with the membership, and they understood that the plan was being overfunded. We were all a little hesitant. But what drove the contribution rate reduction was something that was already written into law. And the police and fire statute had language in it that said, if we continued to be overfunded and our contribution was more than we needed to bring that down considerably. The Pension Commission's actuary at the time said if we followed the letter of the law, we would have lowered that rate far more than what we actually did. So where we ended up at 15.5% was a compromise with the employers that fund the plan, the members who contribute to the plan, and discussions with the Pension Commission and its actuary. So the decision was made jointly with the stakeholders involved. What happened, however, I believe, is that we didn't react fast enough when the market started eroding the value of the assets to get that contribution moving upward again. So when we did, when we finally did, we had to bring it up to a much higher rate than people were comfortable with. But again, it was a decision by the stakeholders involved, members, employers, the Pension Commission, and the legislature in reaching the terms of the bill, the terms of the changes.
Follow-up question, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wasn't in the legislature around here, and in the late 90s, some people maybe were or remember it, but was there, in terms of the employer contribution on a plan like this, which also went down, was there, to put it delicately, was there political pressure at the time like there was with the state general fund budget that this was sort of government keeping the people's money and we ought to give it back and that kind of thing and not put as much of into it in reserve? Or is that really apples to oranges, that comparison?
Ms. Vanek.
And I only ask because it seems to me if that was the case that you're always doing a delicate dance. If you're underfunded, people attack you and say you weren't smart and you didn't plan and this is sort of government run amok. And if you're overfunded, people say you're keeping the people's money and you ought to give it back. So it seems to me you're always, it's a delicate dance there.
Ms. Vanek, and perhaps Representative Simon's question earlier made me come up with a follow-up question. That is, you had mentioned that it was in statute that talked about the funding, but then we made compromises. Well, if it's in statute, how exactly does that work? We just kind of ignored the statute, or which is, you know, obviously probably a good thing here, but I'm a little fuzzy still on the process.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, again, I'll go back to the contribution is always shared 40-60. So when there was a decision made that because the plan was so well funded, that they we could lower contributions for a period of time. It was lowered, keeping the 40-60 split in mind. And yes, there were concerns, I believe, in the discussions that the benefit structure was being improved over time because it was so well funded. So the stakeholder employers and the stakeholder membership groups met together and talked about it and reached a compromise. The reason that we didn't follow statute is we were a bit conflicted. Our contribution rates were set in statute. Okay, they were specifically stated. And then there was language that talked about lowering them, but when our attorney reviewed that, he wasn't comfortable in the way it was written. So he said we should go back to the legislature and work with the Pension Commission on what was intended by the language that said, if you're collecting more than you needed, bring it down to a certain level. And we engaged the commission's actuary in that discussion because we were so well funded and our contributions were so much more than what we needed. The commission's actuary was actually the most concerned about how far you'd bring those rates down without running into trouble with the plan funding in a very short term. So it did end up, Madam Chair, being a discussion with the Pension Commission because we were uncomfortable that the language that was directing us to lower those contributions wasn't clear enough and could have created some problems going forward.
Okay. And I think Representative Nelson had a question, and then we'll go to Ms. Hacking after that for our final few minutes here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. And when Ms. Vanek was talking, it reminded me, when we're talking of comparing these with private sector plans that are covered by ERISA up until recently, again, if they were 110% funded, they were required by law, federal law, to either improve benefits or reduce payments to them. Also, in ERISA plans, they're to be backed by that, you have to have a five-year vesting. And so any private pension plan you're in after 5 years, you're 100% vested in the money you have there. And the other thing is they have a rating system. When we talk about the sufficiency numbers here, that they've got a red, yellow, and green rating form, and down to 85% funded, they're in the green, which means they're okay. I think it's down to 65%. They call it the yellow, which means you need to look at it and maybe make changes to them. If you're in the red, then you're deficient, and then they're supposed to be making changes to shore them up. So I mean, so that's similar funding what they're doing here, and so just to compare them, what they're doing here is quite similar to what you'd have to do if they were a private plan.
Thank you. Okay, if it's all right, we'll move on to Ms. Hacking. Please proceed and state your name for the record.
Thank you. Laurie Hacking with the Teachers Retirement Association. I've been director with TRA for 5 years, prior to that 6 years with the Ohio Public Employees Retirement System, and prior to that 6 years directing CARA. Teachers Retirement covers pretty much all K-12 public school teachers and administrators. That includes charter schools and some, but not all, the state university and community college faculty. We're governed by an 8-member board of trustees. 4 of those members are elected from active and 1 from retiree population. And then there are 3 statutory appointments, MMB, Department of Education, and the School Boards Association. We have assets as of the end of the fiscal year, $14.9 billion. Again, due to considerably good returns, that asset level is up to $16.9 billion currently. We have active membership of over 77,000, benefit recipients of 52,000, and deferred members of close to 13,000. Here's our funding history, and we'll focus on just the market value. We, like the other funds, were in much better shape just a few years ago. In 2007, we were 93% funded, but due to market declines, we hit a low point last year of just under 60%, which caused us to take actions with the benefit reform bill that I'll mention in a moment. We are starting to recover. We were up to 67.6% funded this in 2010, and that improvement was largely due to the benefit reforms that I'll speak to in just a minute. If we were to put the dipstick in today with our higher asset level, we would probably be in the range of 73 to 74% funded. So we are making significant strides. The bottom of this page shows you our contribution rate history. The red line is the employer rate, the blue line, the employee rate. What is very notable there is that the employer rate, that is what's paid by school districts, was a lot higher during most of the 1980s into the 1990s. That rate was around 8 to 9%. That dropped significantly in 1997. Same sort of factors that you've heard described here before. We reached 100% funded. In fact, we were higher than 100% funded, and it was felt that the funding was no longer needed for TRA. So by statute, that contribution rate went down dramatically, not just for the employee, but the employer. Since then, we have stabilized 5.5%, but you'll see in a minute, and under the pension reform proposal from last year, we're going to need additional contribution rates into the future in order to get us stable again. The pension reforms that were passed last year, very similar to what you've heard described by the other two funds. I'll just highlight a couple of differences. On the annual increases for retirees, we actually took a little more dramatic approach or more significant cut in the short term. We are actually freezing retiree increases as of January of this year and next year. So it's a two-year freeze. And the reason we did that, unlike the other funds, is that we needed money more in the short term. We are very retiree liability heavy, and this was an important factor to getting us back on our feet. We will then go to 2% increases until the funding ratio attains 90%. Similar changes, deferred augmentation was lowered to 2%. Contribution rate increases, we are going to see a gradual increase in both employee and employer rates of 0.5% per year starting in July 2011. And so the employer and employee rates will stay in sync, so that the employee and employers are sharing equally in the cost of taking the plan forward. We did not make any change in our vesting. We remain at 3 years. Refund interest rate, same as the other plans. And all totaled, the reduction in unfunded liabilities, again, just due to the benefit changes, were $1.75 billion. So very significant change. Some have expressed interest in what's going on in other states. Other states have been taking action similar to what Minnesota has considered. This is just a sampling of what other states have done in recent years. There are actually a lot more states. Many of them, actually 14, have increased employee contribution rates. And I might emphasize here that there are a number of these states that had no employee contribution contributions at all to the plan. So for new hires, like for example in Missouri, newly hired employees will have to contribute 4%. Virginia, they'll have to contribute 5%. But again, in past years, they had not been contributing anything, which is in sharp contrast to Minnesota, where the discipline has been that the employee has pretty much borne a significant part of the cost of the plan through their contributions. I might mention New York is another example. They have only paid employees pay in 3%, but only for the first 10 years of their tenure. Now that will be changing. For new hires, they will be paying in 3%, 3.5% for their entire career. Other states have also increased employer contribution rates, some significantly. And many of them have changed cost of living adjustments. Representative Beard isn't here right now, but I wanted to point out that the lawsuit that is pending in our state is very similar to two other states, Colorado and South Dakota. In fact, it's the same law firm which is handling the case in those states as well. So you've seen other states also change their annual adjustments. Plan design changes, a lot of changes here. I'll just name a few. For example, in California, for new hires, their normal retirement age, that's the full benefit retirement age, is going from 55 to age 60. In Illinois, their normal retirement age is going from age 60 to 67. Pennsylvania is going from 60 to 65, and other changes like that. There are two states which have initiated a new hybrid plan, Utah and Michigan, in the recent years. And a number of states are looking at their investment return assumption as well. Just to highlight briefly, again, how we compare to other states, as you've heard described before, Minnesota has been pretty disciplined in taking care of its funding problems when they have occurred. We've generally been, I'd say, more conservative about taking care of our obligations and keeping our benefits relatively modest. Our public employer contributions represent about 1.6% of total Minnesota state local spending. That's in contrast to 2.9%, which is the average for other states. And this is based on Census Bureau data. We've been proactive about benefit reforms and making changes. Many of you are aware, been here for a while, that our annual adjustment mechanism was a bit was providing very large increases when we had big investment returns in the late 1970s. That was corrected. Those increases were capped, and eventually that mechanism eliminated and instead replaced by what we have now. I spoke about other states raising their normal retirement age from 60 to 65 or 66, 67. Minnesota did that many years ago. In 1989, all newly hired employees, the retirement age is now age 66. So Minnesota's had that reform in place for a long time. At the same time, the rule of 90 was eliminated, so there's the early retirement benefits are not at all as generous as what you see in other states. Three-fourths of our active population today are under these new rules, with an age 66 retirement age and no rule of 90. And as I mentioned before, employees contribute generally half of the cost, with the exception being for public safety. The pension reform bill, as we said earlier, was very, very important to us, and we appreciate the bipartisan support and the governor's support for this legislation. It has made a world of difference in the ability of our plans to be sustainable in the future. We spoke about the legal challenge. I'll mention one last thing. The pension reform bill asks the three funds to conduct a benefit design study of alternatives to our current defined benefit plans. We are working on that. That is due to the legislature. And on June 1 of 2011, we've had public stakeholder meetings on this. In fact, the next one is scheduled for February 1. It's been very well attended. We had over 80 participants in our last meeting. Our actuarial analysis, which our actuary will do, is in process. That isn't completed yet. We intend to circulate a draft in March with our stakeholder groups and get comments and feedback so that we can finalize the report and transmit it by June 1.
I think we have a couple of member questions. We are at our time limit, so if we could keep them short, and then I have a couple of housekeeping items too. Representative Quam?
Madam Chair, Director Hacking, can I have the data as a percent of salaries instead of total spending when you do the comparison of Minnesota versus the U.S.?
I will try to see if I can get that. I'm not familiar with the data. So it's percent of...
In other words...
Percent of Quam.
Oh, sorry, Madam Chair. Instead of total state spending, which varies to a great degree, I think a better metric would be contribution versus total salaries for employees.
Okay. Ms. Hacking.
I'll try to get that.
Okay. And Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Hacking. I guess the question I have, seeing as how Representative Beard isn't here now, is his question earlier about the effect of the merger of the Minneapolis teachers into the Teachers Retirement Association. How much of that has contributed to the deficit in there, or has it contributed to the deficit at all?
Ms. Hacking.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, very good question. We've had that question a lot. Basically, when the Minneapolis Teachers Fund was brought in to TRA, we, along with it, came additional contributions that the school district is making. In fact, the Minneapolis School District has to contribute an extra 3.64% for every active employee teacher that they have. So we got additional contributions, or are getting additional contributions from the school district. We are also getting aid from the state, which originally had been going to Minneapolis, is now directed to us. So basically, when Minneapolis came in, we were to TRA, we were given the additional resources to take care of those liabilities. And put a little different way, had the Minneapolis merger never happened, we still would have had this this situation, because it's really due to the market downturn, the severe market downturn.
Well, thank you. Thanks, everyone who testified today. That gave us a very good overview of where our state funds are at. Housekeeping item. Tomorrow we'll be hearing House File 4. Because we had a long holiday weekend, I want to give you an opportunity to have any amendments to Rory by 4 o'clock today instead of noon. And we will also tomorrow have a presentation from the Campaign Finance Board. We're going to add that to our agenda. With that, meeting adjourned.